Okay, hello everybody. Welcome to Why Capitalism Lecture 5. Before I get going on today's lecture, I wanted to make one comment on the quiz for Lecture 4. Going through the quiz, I was a bit surprised, although maybe I shouldn't have been, maybe I just worded this question badly. There was one question where I asked about, I think it was question 9, which person did not, repeat not, think it was important to limit population? And several people answered that it was Malthus who was the one who thought it wasn't important to limit population. And that isn't correct, because remember, Malthus is the one who's saying how bad things are because population will always increase faster than the means of subsistence, so there's always a pressure on means of subsistence from population. So he thought it would, if you could limit population, that would be a very good thing. He didn't think people would be able to do it. And he also thought that certain means of doing it, such as birth control, would be immoral, but he certainly wasn't someone who thought it wasn't important to limit population. It was just he didn't think he could do it. The one who thought it wasn't important to limit population was Julian Simon, because he thought that basically the more people, the better. So that's why he wouldn't think it was important to limit population. Okay, so much for quiz number 4. I'm certainly glad I don't have to take my quizzes. It's hard enough writing them, let alone taking them. Okay, what happened here? Okay, so today what we're going to be discussing is economic developments, of course, a very big subject today, and how nations get out of being poor and the role of foreign aid in getting nations out of being poor. Even though Mises and Henry Hazlitt were writing quite some time ago, what they say is extremely relevant to what's going on in the world now. Supposing you were to ask people today, even many economists, why is it that some nations aren't doing well? Say if you were living in Somalia or Bangladesh, you wouldn't be doing as well as if you're living in the United States. Why is that? Why do we find that some nations, such as our own, are very highly developed and some nations aren't? Now, one answer that I'd say would be probably the most popular one today is that say, supposing a nation starts off very poor, and after all, that's where nations do start off. Riches don't grow on trees, after all. You have to do something to get wealthy. So supposing a nation, just people in the nation just don't have very much. So then the argument is, well, what's going to happen then? Anything they produce will really have to go just to feed themselves or to take care of elementary needs like housing, if they can get housing. And they'll be operating at a very low level, so they won't be able to really get out of it. Their poor position, they just won't have, everything they produce will just have to go for their basic upkeep. We also have an explanation of that for poverty of individuals within a country. Say you find today in the United States, there are some people who are very poor, and one argument on why those people are poor is that, well, if say they don't have much to begin with, say they're out in the street, they just have to, maybe they have to beg for money, or they do just very small jobs, then anything they go will just have to go for food and shelter if they can find it. They won't be able to do anything else. So the argument is both for individuals and for countries, which is the principal topic we're considering now, that the reason nations are poor is just that once they start being poor, they really can't get out of it because anything they produce will just have to go to meeting their basic needs. If they don't meet those, then they'll be dead. So once you're in this poor state of affairs, you can't get out of it. It's a bit like what's supposed to be true of black holes in astronomy. Once you're near one, you can't get out of it. You're stuck there. So this explanation, as you can see why, it's called the cycle of poverty. You can see why that name is appropriate, because it said once you're in a poor state, you're not going to be able to get out of it, at least not very easily. You're caught in it. Among economists who favor that view, we could think of the Swedish socialist Gunnar Myrdal and John Kenneth Galbraith, who was a very prominent economist some years ago. He wrote the famous book, Affluent Society. He also wrote on aid, and he stressed this as kind of aid, the poverty, cycle of poverty. You're caught in this cycle, you can't get out. And he's supposing you hold that view, you say people are in this cycle of poverty. Once they're poor, they can't get out of it. Then what are you going to say? Well, suppose you want them to, you're interested in economic development. Well, if they can't get out of it themselves, then some other country has to come to their aid. So this cycle of poverty argument is used as a justification for foreign aid. The view is, look, these people in this poor nation like Somalia or Bangladesh, they can't get out of being poor by themselves because anything they produce will just have to go for elementary needs. So the way they can get out of it is if government gives them a lot of money or sends them goods, so then maybe they can get out of being poor. Oddly enough, Galbraith himself didn't use the argument for to justify foreign aid. He wasn't opposed to foreign aid, but he pretty much thought that if you're in the cycle of poverty, you're really going to have a great deal of trouble getting out of it, even if you do get foreign aid. So he was really a committed believer in the cycle of poverty view. But most people who favor that use it, as I say, to justify foreign aid. Now, what's wrong with the cycle of poverty argument? Remember, the argument is if you start off poor, then you're going to stay poor because you have to spend anything you produce will go to elementary needs. So we could see maybe what's wrong with this right away is we just add a particular premise to the argument, empirical fact that all nations started off poor. I mean, after all, as I say, wealth doesn't grow on trees. You have to do something. You have to produce wealth if you want to avoid being poor. So you can see what the problem is. The cycle of poverty argument, it says, if a nation's poor, it's going to stay that way. And then we have the additional premise, all nations start out poor. So what follows from that? Well, if all nations start out poor, and once you're poor, you're going to stay poor, then we get the conclusion that all nations will always remain poor. And of course, that's false. That's empirically false because there are some nations like our own country, America. I shouldn't say our own because probably some of you aren't listening in from America. But America is one, it's not a very poor country. There are a lot of countries today that aren't poor. But this argument, if it were true, a cycle of poverty argument says once you're poor, that's it, then we'd all be poor because everybody, all nations started off poor. So see, we know there must be something wrong with the cycle of poverty argument because it has a false conclusion. If we have an argument that derives from which we derive a conclusion that's false, there must be something wrong with the argument. I mean, supposing we had an argument purporting to show that the Civil War in the United States had never taken place, there'd been no such thing as a Civil War, then we know there's something wrong with that argument. We've derived a false premise, a false conclusion from our premises, so we know something's wrong with it. So similarly here, we know something's wrong with this argument because it would have a conclusion that all nations are now poor, which is false. But that doesn't tell us what's wrong with the argument. It just says there's something wrong with it because we've got an incorrect, the conclusion is false, since not all nations are poor. And this argument, if it were true, would imply that all nations are poor. So what's wrong with the argument? Well, remember, the cycle of poverty argument says that if a nation's poor, then they're going to have to devote all their resources just to meeting their elementary needs like food and clothing. But that isn't true, even if they have to spend almost everything they produce on food and clothing. At least some people, some of the time, are able to save, and once they do that, they can build tools, and then they can increase their productivity. So even if you can save only a small amount, if you're devoting some, just a little bit of your production to building up your tools, building up your capital equipment, then it's false that you have to devote all your resources to just meeting your elementary needs. And if you're able to save up and invest, you'll gradually be able to get out of poverty. So it isn't true, the cycle of poverty argument isn't correct. It isn't true that once you're poor, you're doomed to remain poor forever. It might very well be difficult to get out of the poor state of affairs, but it's not impossible, as the cycle argument would suggest. So, as I've just said, savings and investment are the key to getting out of poverty. We've discussed this quite a bit in previous lectures, that if you have capital goods like tools and equipment, you can produce much more than if you just have to rely on just human labor and just natural undeveloped resources. Once you start having advanced tools, you can produce much more. So the key is you have to start saving. That's say you devote some money or some time to producing these capital goods, so then that'll enable you to produce more. And so there's no, as I said before, repeat, there's no cycle of poverty that dooms a nation. That dooms a nation to poverty forever. So the cycle of poverty argument is wrong. Now, one point, this again is one that Mises stresses, Julian Simon wouldn't agree with this, what Mises says is what's important is not just to get out of poverty, is not just that the amount of capital in the economy is increasing, but that the ratio of capital to population is going up. There'll be more capital per worker than there was before, and that'll raise the wages of each worker, because remember, workers tend to get what they produce. When an employer is thinking, should I hire a particular worker, he's going to ask, what will this worker contribute to production? And what the worker contributes to production will determine how much the employer will offer him or her. Obviously, the employer won't offer the worker more than he's contributing to production, then I mean that wouldn't make any sense, and he won't be able to offer him much less than that because then competing firms will bid the worker away. We discussed that last week. So what Mises said is, okay, the way you get out of poverty is that you increase the spending, the capital goods, and you also have to make sure that the population doesn't just keep increasing also, because if you have an increase in population at the same time as capital is going up, then there won't be more capital per worker. The additional population will drive wages down again. You see, there's kind of a somewhat Malthusian element in Mises. Malthus said, well, population is inevitably won't be able to get above subsistence, because if it does, then there'll be simply more workers produced, and they'll drive wages down again. Because remember, if you increase the supply of something, including labor, you're lowering the price. So Mises says, well, it isn't inevitable that that will happen, but if population does keep increasing more than investment in capital goods, then wages aren't going to go up. So the key for wages to go up is that the ratio of capital to population increases. Now, again, we discussed this in previous lectures. England was the first nation that escaped from poverty for most people. Up till the Industrial Revolution in England, practically everybody lived in a very bad state of affairs. We tend to forget about this when we're studying history, because history is, as usually taught, is largely what the people in the upper classes were doing. People, if you look at the great leaders, if you're studying Caesar or Napoleon or any of the great leaders, obviously these people are not impoverished. So if you just study political and diplomatic history, you're going to get a misleading picture, because you won't be thinking most people are really not doing very well at all. And this changed when the Industrial Revolution came about. After the Industrial Revolution, large masses of people in England were able to live on a higher level. Remember, I mentioned there's a controversy about when, how much after the Industrial Revolution this increase in standard of living for the masses took place. The free market position, one that Mises, Henry Hazlitt, and Friedrich Hayek hold, is that the Industrial Revolution improved things right away for workers. But the more left-wing view, the Marxist view, is no, the Industrial Revolution made things worse. But the key point here, we have to remember, even the Marxists have to admit, well, things did get better after a while, even if they think things got worse, I think wrongly. But even they have to admit, well, things did get better at some time in the 19th century, even though we have to kind of drag this out of them, that this goes against their preconceptions. But things were getting better for the workers in England after the Industrial Revolution. So then we just apply this point, well, Britain got out of poverty for the masses. So if one country, they could do it, why not others? Why can't other countries follow in their footsteps? And other countries would find it easier to get out of poverty than the British did, because remember, they'd have the benefits of British inventions and technology if they're able to save. As Mises again and again points out, it isn't enough to have ideas. People in poor nations, say the educated class, would be very aware of science and technology. They'd know all the different inventions. But what you need is the money to buy the capital equipment. They have to buy be able to buy or produce the necessary tools and technology to be able to get out of poverty. It is enough to know about the ideas. But again, if one nation can get out of poverty, as Britain did, why not others as well? So see, the cycle of poverty argument, as we said, doesn't work. Now, in the selection from we had for today's lecture from Mises, he raises what I consider a really deep and interesting question. I find when I'm reading Mises, no matter how many times I've read him, there are always new insights, things that you missed before, at least that I missed before when I was reading. And one that he makes in this selection, he raises this question. He says, well, supposing, as happened, other nations followed in Britain's footsteps in the 19th century, like France and Germany after 1870. Of course, before 1870-71, there was no Germany. With separate states, but remember, Germany became a unified country after what war did, does anyone know, after what war did Germany become a unified country? Can anybody tell me that? Don't all hurry up for the answer. Okay, it was the Franco-Prussian War. Well, let's mention war with Austria. That was 1866. That was one of the three wars of German unification. Remember, Denmark 1864, Austria 1866, and France 1870-71. But it didn't become a unified country until after the war with France. Okay, so the question is, supposing, as happened, all these other nations start industrializing too. They start developing their economy. So they're going to do better than they did before, but how would they ever catch up with England? Because unless England stopped industrializing, remember, because they've just started, but Britain's already going. It's something like, that'd be a good analogy. Imagine you're trying to build a skyscraper and someone's already halfway finished before you start, so then this person is probably going to finish first. I mean, you could imagine situations where, say, the new person's producing much faster than the other one, but you wouldn't really expect this. You would think, well, the one that started first is going to get a big advantage. You see, once you started investing, then your further investment can just keep increasing. It's just like another way of looking at it. Suppose you start a savings account in the bank, so your money will, you say they're paying you interest, and your money will keep getting more, you get more and more money. But if somebody already has a lot of money in the bank and you're getting the same interest, you're not going to catch up with that person. That person has a head start that you're not going to be able to surmount. So here, the other nations are starting from a smaller base. So suppose you just take a nation, say, that starts to industrialize in 1850. Well, Britain had grown a lot by 1850. So how could the other nation catch up? How would this head start be overcome if it could? And of course, we know it was because, say, the economy in Germany was growing, tended to, by the early 20th century, was growing much faster than the British. It was replacing the British somewhat many areas. The American economy was becoming the strongest in the world, not the British. So how did this happen? Well, the answer is that other nations of Europe and elsewhere benefited from foreign investment from Britain. So it's true the British were more advanced than the other countries, so they were going from a head start. But the other nations didn't have to come up with the capital just on their own. They could borrow capital from British investors. So that's how these other nations could catch up, because the investors in the advanced country are investing in the less advanced country. So it isn't the case then that the nations that started off in an inferior position are doomed to remain that way. So there isn't kind of a cycle of inferiority corresponding to the cycle of poverty argument. We say, remember, the cycle of poverty argument is saying, well, if you start poor, you're never going to get out of it. So we could imagine a cycle of inferiority argument that says, well, if you start off below a certain nation, you're never going to be able to catch up. And that isn't right, because the advanced nation can invest in the less advanced one, and then they can catch up. This British investment wasn't confined to Europe. Say there was extensive British investment in India, and also British capital played a very prominent role in American industrial development. As we know, if you study American economic history, railroads were extremely important in the development of the American economy in the late 19th century, and the British helped finance a lot of the American railroad development. So the British were, in the 19th century, were in advance of all the other countries, but because they were in advance, they had money to invest in these other countries, and that enabled the other countries to close the gap. They were able to catch up. They're using some of the investment that Britain, the most advanced country, had gotten. So the British had much more investment than these other countries, but the British didn't keep their investment in their own country. They invested them in other countries, and that enabled the gap between Britain and the other nations to be closed, or at least not fully, at least to a great extent. Now, one thing, it's a paradox we could call attention to, let's imagine you're the leader of one of these underdeveloped countries. Okay, imagine you're the head of the government in India right after World War II. So you see your country's not doing very well. Your country's in very poor, so you want to build up the economy as much as you can. So you might think, well, what you should do is encourage foreign investment as much as you can, because it's foreign investment that builds up prosperity. And we've gone through the argument, why is that? Well, because if you have foreign investment, the way to increase prosperity is is to have more capital goods. With foreign investment, you don't have to rely on the nation's own ability to save and invest. You can get investment from the most advanced countries. So it would be something like you can get help from foreign investors. You don't have to do it all yourself. It would be something like, supposing you're trying to lift a weight, it's much easier to do it if you have help from someone who's very strong and can help you lift it than if you had to do it yourself. So you would think that governments would be very anxious to get investment. They wouldn't stand in the way of investment, because this is what's going to develop their economy. This is how they're going to get out of being poor. But that isn't the case, and especially wasn't the case when Mises was writing in the early 1950s, and also when Hazlitt was writing in problem of poverty was about 20 years after that. And it's still true that many governments are very suspicious of foreign investment. When someone sets up a factory in a foreign country, they might confiscate or nationalize the factory, or they'll impose heavy taxes on foreign investment. So when they're doing that, they're interfering with their own prosperity, their own efforts to get out of poverty, because, as we said already many times, the way to get out of poverty is to invest. You have to build up the capital in the economy. That way you can have tools and technology, labor will be much more productive. And with foreign investment, you don't have to rely on the nation's own ability, people in the nation, to come up with the necessary savings investment. You can get the investment from foreign investors who are trying to earn money. So if they invest in your country, that's going to increase the standard of living. But nevertheless, a lot of countries don't like foreign investment. They interfere with it. And Mises gives one example of this. He refers to Jawaharlal Nehru, the great prime minister of India right after independence, and in 1947. And Nehru was writing, he was trying to encourage investment in India. He said, well, okay, if you invest, you don't have to worry, we won't nationalize you for 10 years. So you can imagine how an investor in a foreign country going to feel about that. He said, oh, well, he's not going to want to invest because Nehru's going to say, maybe in 10 years they're going to nationalize the company. And the odd thing is, Nehru thought, when he was saying that he won't nationalize the companies for 10 years, he thought that was encouraging investment. It was just that the climate was so hostile to foreign investments that when he said he's not going to nationalize investments for 10 years, he took that to be something very favorable to investment. So it shows how hostile to investment the climate of opinion was at the time. Now, as if this wasn't bad enough for foreign investment, we have people in the underdeveloped nations saying, look, we're very suspicious of foreign investment. If you invest in our country, we're going to subject you to very close regulation, and then maybe we'll nationalize your company, we will tax it. So that's going to discourage foreign investment. But it's also the case, if that wasn't bad enough, there are some people in advanced countries that oppose foreign investment. And why is that? Well, they say, look, what happens when you invest for investment? Well, by definition, you're sending money out of the country. That just is what evolved. That's what foreign investment is. You're taking certain money, you're investing it in a foreign country. You're not investing it in the U.S., or say if that's the country you're concerned with, you're sending it abroad. So the ones who are opposed to foreign investment from the standpoint of the advanced countries say, well, look, if you didn't spend the money on these foreign countries, you could have used that to employ citizens of the advanced country. Why should we say, if we're in the United States, why should we care about helping out the economy of India? Why don't we spend the money on trying to employ U.S. citizens? Don't we have an unemployed of our own? We shouldn't be concerned with all these foreigners. And I'm sure, as you recognize, there are a lot of people today who argue in that way. They'll say, we have enough trouble at home, so we should spend the money here. Why help advance other countries? Why not just think of our own people? But one problem that Henry Hazlitt points out with this attitude, this way of looking at things, is remember, this way of looking at things is saying, well, look, if you have foreign investment, then it's having the money leave the country. The money could have been used here. Why are we sending it out of the country? Well, one thing wrong with that argument, there's a lot wrong with it, but one thing wrong with it is if the investment is successful, say if the investors are earning profit on their investment, then money will be coming back to the home country. It isn't that when you're now Travis says this is a mercantilist mentality. Yeah, that's a very good point. But in fact, money's coming back to the home country because there are returns to the investment. It's not that you're just giving up something to foreign countries. The donor country is benefiting if the investments are successful. Now, also, if you have foreign investment, and say the economy of the donor country, let's say, is growing as a result of the profits of the people who invested in made these foreign investments, that also permits greater employment in the investing country. So remember, the argument was that the people who were opposed to foreign investment saying, well, look, let's take the USA, we're giving aid to India, we're giving investing in India, so what's going to happen? The employers are not employing American workers. Maybe they think they can get cheaper labor in India, so they're sending the money over there, but then look at these poor workers in America who could have gotten the money. They could have been employed, so foreign investment is bad. But what needs to be pointed out is that if foreign investment results in the American economy growing, say people have more money in this country because they make profit from their investment, this also permits greater employment in America, in the investing country, because people will have more money to spend on consumption goods, on other things, so there'll be more demand for labor. So it isn't as if, well, it's if you spend money on foreign workers, then it's too bad for American workers. If the economy's growing, you'll be able, as a result of foreign investment, you'll be able to increase the demand for domestic workers also. Now, some people have a picture that say, well, look, these foreign investments are throwing American workers out of work because if we didn't have a foreign investment, then the American workers would be doing that. Say, you invest money in India and making computers, then it's throwing American computer programmers out of work. But the fact of the matter is that if, say, you're using foreign workers rather than American workers in a particular industry, it doesn't follow there's nothing more for the American workers to do because of the human wants are really unlimited. There's always a scarcity of labor relative to demand, so there are always other productive activities that the workers who were displaced by the foreign investment can do instead. So it isn't that we shouldn't view this as what they call it, a zero-sum game, which we either help the foreign workers or the American workers. If we invest in the foreign workers, then there'll be other things for American workers to do as well. there isn't this, it isn't that it's one group benefits or the other. Everybody benefits through investment. Now, to get back to the country that's getting the foreign investment, it's not only the political leaders like Nehru in India who are suspicious of foreign investment, saying, well, we're going to subject this foreign investment to very close supervision, maybe we'll nationalize some of the companies. A lot of people in the country will complain about the foreign investment. So they'll say, you think they'd be happy because the foreign investment is allowing the economy to grow without the country having to save up the capital itself. So say the poor country doesn't have to say, well, we just have to postpone consumption and wait till we can build up, save enough money to buy tools and technology. They can get the money from the foreign investors. So you think they might be happy about it, but they're not. They say, well, this leads to foreign control of the economy. Say you have the British investing in India, and the British are going to control the economy in India, and money will be sent out of the country. Now, I put down here one book, was very influential, came out in 1940 by someone from India named R. Palm Dutt. It was Rajani Palm Dutt. He wrote a book called India Today that came out in 1940. He was a leading member of the British Communist Party. What he said was really the British in investing in India really were looking out for what was good for Britain, and they suppressed native industries to the benefit of the British. They wanted the Indians to work on, say, producing certain raw materials rather than develop their own native industry. So what Dutt was saying, and others were saying, was, look, foreign investment really isn't so good for the foreign country. It just subjects the economy to control by the more advanced nation. But Henry Hazlitt, I think, as you might expect, has a very good response to this. Remember, the complaint is, well, if you have foreign capital, then invested in the country, then money is going to the foreign country. It's really up to the foreign country to say what kind of investment there is going to be. So isn't this really not so good for the poor country, because then there you have all these projects that are under foreign control. But what's wrong with that argument is, well, it's not looking at the alternative. The alternative is not, instead of having the projects under foreign control, say instead of having Britain control parts of the Indian economy, what they're investing in, you have British companies that would be controlling. The alternative isn't, well, you didn't have the British, then the native people in India would be controlling all the investment. You wouldn't have the same. It isn't that there's a particular investment, say a particular faction, and you say, well, who's going to control it? The British or the people of India? If you wouldn't have the investment at all if there weren't the foreign investment. And has it, I think, very effectively. Use an example. Suppose there's some people in Pennsylvania who borrow money from New York so they use it for a particular investment. So, of course, if they borrow the money from New York, then money to repay the loans would be going to New York. So, but it wouldn't make sense if, because that people in Pennsylvania said, well, look, isn't this awful? Money, instead of being spent on the Pennsylvania economy, is going to New York. These New Yorkers are really taking control of our economy. This is very unfair. Why should we send money to them? Why don't we get to control our own economy? And of course, what this would neglect, what that is, that there wouldn't be the investment in the first place if they didn't borrow the money, because if they didn't have to borrow the money for the project, they could have just done it themselves. They would have done so, but the fact they borrowed the money shows there wouldn't have been a project, really strongly indicates there wouldn't have been a project without the borrowed money. So applying this to the example of foreign investments, really the same point, is it isn't that if you didn't have the foreign investment, then the country would just be producing everything, the same goods by themselves. It's without the foreign investment, you wouldn't have the goods, that the same goods, because you need just the fact that you had to borrow the money shows you couldn't have done it by yourself. At least strongly indicates that, as I said. Now, in talking about how a poor country can develop its economy, a lot of people, unfortunately including some economists, favor protective tariffs. Generally, economists are against tariffs, but there are some people, some economists make an exception for economies that are just developing. They're trying to build up industries. Some of you may know this is a so-called infant industries argument. So the infant industries argument is that free trade is all right once, say, a nation has built up its economy. But if you don't have protection to begin with, then the economy will never get industrialized, because the industries of the more advanced countries will always be more efficient than these new industries that are just getting started. So you have to have tariffs to begin with to build up an industrial base. And then once you have industrial base, then maybe you can talk about free trade, but you know, you have to have tariffs to get started. And probably those of you who are familiar with the basic free market arguments will know some of the problems with, general problems with arguments for tariffs. I imagine everybody in the class would know the argument that trade takes place only if it benefits all parties to exchange. So, as we know, supposing, say, we just take a trade between two people, say, I have apples and you have oranges, and we trade, I give you some of my apples, you give me some oranges in return. Well, we wouldn't have made that trade unless we both expected to benefit, unless we both thought we'd get something out of it, then we wouldn't be trading. So, of course, that applies not just to individuals, but applies to in domestic trade, applies to international trade as well. So we know if you have an interference with trade, if you say, well, you're going to have a tariff to prevent, make it difficult for people to buy foreign goods, that's going to interfere with the people who wanted to buy the foreign goods. They wouldn't have bought, they wouldn't buy foreign goods unless they thought they'd benefit from doing so. So if you have tariffs, you're interfering with what those people take to be good for themselves. So we all know that's one argument against tariffs, that it interferes with people's efforts to benefit themselves through free exchanges with others. But in the selection we had today, Mises makes an additional point. I thought this was, again, a very quite deep point, but one that's very relevant to economic development. Remember, the argument we want to consider is until a nation can build up its industries, you need to have tariffs, because otherwise the industries won't be able to get started. They'll always lose out to the more efficient industries of the advanced economies that they'd be in competition with. So the argument that we gave just before, that people won't engage in trade unless all the parties to it expect a benefit, is certainly true. It's certainly a good argument, but it doesn't really address this concern that we won't be able to get industries started unless you have tariff protection. So Mises has what I think is a quite remarkable answer, that he says, again, very often what he tries to do in his arguments, he'll show, well, okay, let's accept the goal of the person who wants to interfere with the free market, and show that the means to that he's adopted to the goal won't enable him to achieve that. So here what we have is, people say, well, we want to build up a domestic industry, and then the way we're going to do that is to have tariffs in the beginning, because then the industry will be shielded from foreign competition, more efficient foreign competition of the advanced economy, till you can get an industry started. So what Mises says is, this isn't going to work, not that you couldn't build up a particular industry that way. Say if you built a steel factory that wasn't so efficient, you could certainly do that and by tariffs get people to buy from that industry, but you won't have a total increase in investment. What you'd have if you do that would be people would be spending money on, say, buying more expensive steel they would have spent on other things. If they could buy the steel more cheaply abroad, they'd have more money to spend on other things. And here, if they're spending the money on the domestic steel that benefits from protective tariffs, they'll have less money to spend on other things. The only way you could have an increase in total investment, not just in investment in a particular industry, is you have to have an increase in total capital. You have to have people saving, and then the total capital will go up. And that's the way you achieve prosperity, not just by developing particular industries. So if you don't have capital growing, if you don't have an increase in total capital, tariffs will just cause a switch to the industries that benefit from the subsidies. So they won't really be aiding economic development, contrary to the supporters of the infant industries argument. Now, from what Mises and Hazlitt have been saying, it's clear how should a nation develop economically. Say a nation's poor, wants to develop economically. How can it do that? Well, the answer we should see is pretty obvious. It just allows the free market to operate, including allowing foreign investment. That way it can build up its capital, and then workers' productivity will go up and workers will have get more and more money, and the nation will be able to get out of poverty. But a lot of people today say, well, the way nations can get out of poverty is through foreign aid. I say where government in the more advanced countries will send money to the underdeveloped countries. So you have, instead of having foreign investment by private investors, in addition to that, you have the government taking money and giving it to the underdeveloped countries. Now, one problem with this, which is pointed out in our reading selections, is that suppose you do that, you give money to the foreign countries, well, where you get the money from it, presumably from taxing the people in the domestic country. So you're taking money away from domestic consumers and producers because the foreign aid money is going to these other countries, and you're hurting the economy because, remember, those people in the domestic economy would have spent that money on their own investment projects. If it's a matter of foreign investment, then the investors are going to, if they invest in foreign countries because they think they'll get more money doing that than investing domestically. But that isn't the case if you just take money away from people, say, in this country. It isn't that they're going to, the foreign projects are going to benefit them more than what they would have spent. You're just taking money away from them. It's just, if they imagine, just like domestically, the government takes taxes you, then you don't have that money available. That certainly hurts you. Now, there's an answer to this that some people say, well, look, it isn't true, at least not for the most part true, that if you spend money on foreign aid, then that's just money that goes out of the country. So you would think, well, if you spend money out of the country, you take money away from people in this country, just tax it away from them, and they're not going to be doing very well. The people in the other country will do well. Just like, imagine, say something, somebody takes $25 from you and gives it to somebody else. So you're not going to be doing well. You're out $25, but the other person is doing well, so it benefits him. So you could say, well, why should the person who has $25 to begin with favor that, because it's just going to lessen what he has? But some people say, look, that isn't right, because sometimes in foreign aid, very often, the people who get the aid will use it to buy products in the domestic products in the country giving the aid. Sometimes that's actually built into the aid bill. It says, say, if the U.S. gives money to India, then it's required that India spend the money over here. So the answer here to the objection to the view that foreign aid is just taking money, say, away from Americans if we're the ones giving the aid, is no, because it isn't hurting America, because the people who get the foreign aid are just going to spend it on American goods. What we have here is just this, the diversion of demand. Of course, if people get aid in a foreign country, if we give them money and they spend it on certain American products, then the people who produce those products are going to benefit. But if you didn't have the foreign aid, then the money wouldn't have been taken away from the American consumers, and they would have spent the money elsewhere. And those of you familiar with the broken window argument will see that's just what's involved here. The argument is saying, look, the foreign aid money really helps America, because the money that we give to the foreign countries is going to be spent on American products, and it's neglecting the fact that if we hadn't sent the money given the money to the foreign country, the people who retain the money would have spent it on other things, and there isn't a gain for net gain for the donors. We have there are some people who benefit in the donor country benefit from the foreign aid, namely the foreigners spend their money on, but there's a loss to those from whom the money is taken away. Now, foreign aid, as you know, isn't just a theoretical idea. And one example of foreign aid, one of the most important ones, was that after World War II, America gave a great deal of foreign aid to help the European countries in economic recovery. The Secretary of State was George Marshall. George Marshall was a very interesting figure. He had been the Army Chief of Staff, and he was one of the leaders in kind of military planning during World War II. He didn't fight in Europe himself, but he was the one who was really in charge. Eisenhower, who was the supreme commander in Europe, had to answer to Marshall. And he'd also gotten into controversy later on. Senator Joe McCarthy of Wisconsin, whom you heard, I'm sure, gave a speech in the Senate, later wrote a book, accusing Marshall of being a communist agent. People started attacking him, and then he had a lot of defenders also. So he became a somewhat controversial figure. But he proposed in 1947 having a plan for foreign aid to the European countries, and this plan was put into effect in 1948. Now, a lot of people, a majority view today, many people think, well, the Marshall Plan really was a good idea because it helped the European countries to recover from the devastation of World War II. But Hazlitt argued, I think very successfully, that the Marshall Plan wasn't needed for European recovery. And he points out, for those who say the Marshall Plan was really responsible for European recovery, he says, well, look, the British economy didn't do very well compared, say, with Germany, even though Britain received substantially more Marshall Plan aid than Germany did. So then what did bring about European recovery? Hazlitt points out to really free market reforms. He especially emphasized in Germany, the economy under the American occupation had been subjected to price controls, but the minister, German economic minister Ludwig Erhard, 1948, ended price controls, restored the free market, and then the German economy did very well. So Hazlitt said, you don't need foreign aid to explain how Europe recovered, especially how Germany recovered. It's just you just have to rely on the free market. And I just thought it was interesting you mentioned Erhard had gotten his PhD in the 1920s under Franz Oppenheimer. Remember, was the one who wrote that book on the state that had so much influence on American libertarians like Albert J. Nock and Frank Chodorov, Murray Rothbard. This has that the state is predatory. So Erhard had been his student. Incidentally, Oppenheimer ended up in the U.S. During World War II. But anyway, so I think we'll stop the lecture now. So we'll go on now to the questions and comments. Now, Malcolm has anyone using an existing Rothbard analysis analyzed the economics and Marshall Plan, the implications of the U.S. economy and industries, and of those receiving aid? I believe there's an article on that by Tyler Cowen that's generally in accord with a kind of a free market approach that you could probably get just by going to Cowen's website and looking that up. I know he's one who wrote on that. He had a very influential, a good paper on that subject. So that would be one person who's written on that. Oh, that was very fast. You found that fast. People on computers can go very fast, much too fast for me. Let's see here. Travis has something here. Last week, we covered how Mises said that money is required for the entrepreneur to launch his enterprise. And if you were poor but a visionary, you could get an investor to jumpstart your business. However, my follow-up question to this is, how do the investor get his money originally? Didn't he receive money initially from another investor at one point in time to jumpstart his own business? And where did this investor get his money originally to invest in the former investor? And I'll apply this concept to the original state of nature. Go back far enough. How did anyone acquire more capital? More capital than anyone else to start an enterprise and begin employing others if there were no investors, anyone who had the equivalency of capital accumulation to begin with. Now, Travis goes on, of course, before there was a monetary economy, everything was based on barter, but how did people engage in a barter economy then without having certain goods being invested first and equated as money in order to start new enterprise that would create more goods? There must have been social cooperation, but how is it possible for one man to become employed by another man when in the original state of nature, no one had an accumulation of any sort of value to initiate the enterprise in the first place? Travis, I've been thinking about this since last week. Do you understand what I'm trying to get at? Sorry it's so long. Well, I think I get what you mean, Travis. That's a very good question, but I did try to address that question a little bit, although not in as quite the terms you put it, when I was talking about problems of the cycle of poverty argument. Remember, cycle of poverty argument is something like the question you're asking is saying, well, look, if people are starting off, they just are meeting their basic needs, how are they ever going to get out of that? So you're asking, well, look, they don't have anything to invest. How could investment ever get started? And the answer is, well, they could just save up a little bit. They don't have to devote all their activities just to meeting their basic needs. They can just save up a little bit. And Leslie has a very good point. He says, in the fishermen who use the time to build more nets rather than fish, say invest. Yes, exactly. I mean, this is how investment gets started first. You don't devote everything just to your immediate needs, but you put some labor aside, you make tools, and you can get the investment started. Malcolm says, same as saving seed for the following season. Yes, that's an excellent point. Yeah, another good example. So, I mean, you're very right in saying there has to be a first investor. It can't be everybody gets something from everybody else, but there can be a first investor as long as somebody could save something from his immediate production. You can do that. At least some people could. So a bit, that's your point. There's a bit like the first mover argument in philosophy. You can't have something that's receiving its motion from something else going in an infinite series. Yes, Malcolm has 12 capital accrues over time in aggregate, not wiped out by war, burned up. Yes, that's right. Now, Malcolm said, is there someone in the immediate Austrian community with a background in investing Rothbardian analysis who you would say was an expert on Roman ancient Greek law? I'd like to learn more about century assembly and how the Roman government operates. If not, what would you recommend reading on this subject? Well, I think Bruno Leone knew quite a bit about Roman law. Mises did himself. I don't know who's written on Roman, from an Austrian point of view, on Roman government, especially, I mean, I think one book you might like is by Sir Ronald Syme, S-Y-M-E, called The Roman Revolution, that came out, I think, published by Oxford, 1939. That's a very good book on the Roman Republic and its end. That might be a good one. I mean, if you're interested in the law, Roman law, I mean, there are various textbooks on that. I think there was one named Joliffe, J-O-L-I-F-F-E, who has a standard book on Roman law. There are various books on that. Travis, I think, so saving is the initial investment in order to employ labor, I guess, then, correct? Yes, that's right. Yes. Malcolm's interested in the processes. Good. Yes, Roman law. Remember, Mises had a doctorate in law. He has his degree is J.U.D., which is Juris Utriusque Doctor, means Doctor of Both Laws, which is, I think, both laws would be civil and Roman law, so that would be part of his, that would be what his doctorate was in. Yes, I mean, there were PhDs in, I think, in Germany at the time. I mean, that, but in Austria, kind of the standard degree for economists was a law degree. So you wouldn't have a PhD in economics. Was the same degree Menger in Bombardier? I'd have to check that. That sounds right, but I'd have to check that. Now, has anyone written on the rise of the PhD, what occurred before and why the rise happened? Well, I think there's a great deal on that. I'd have to look up that's one thing, kind of the professionalization of education, you know, particularly. Of course, Germany led the way to that. You know, the University of Berlin was the most famous European university, and they were the ones who really developed the PhD. And kind of the Germans looked on the Austrians as kind of somewhat of a backwater. So the name Austrian School that we use for Austrian economics was originally given to Menger and his followers by the German economists such as Gustav Schmoller. They intended that as kind of a derogatory term, meaning something like, I could say, well, these are just rustics. They're not really up on things. Now let's see, Danny has quotation from Rothbard, during the 1880s and 1890s, bright young graduate students in history and social science went to Germany, home with a PhD degree, to obtain their doctorate. Almost to a man, they returned to the United States to teach in college and the newly created graduate schools, imbued with the excitement of a new economics and political science. It was a new social science that lauded the German and Bismarckian development of a powerful welfare warfare state seemingly above all social classes, that fused a nation into an integrated, allegedly harmonious whole. Yes, I mean, under the German university, especially in Prussia, the University of Berlin was in Prussia, it was very much under the control of the state, and the economists viewed themselves as under working to advance the state. Remember, the royal palace was right across from the campus of the University of Berlin. So one of the German leaders described himself. The University of Berlin said there's the intellectual bodyguard of the House of Hohenzollern. The House of Hohenzollern is the ruling house in royal family. And when he said that, we said the intellectual bodyguard, they were right. When he said that, they were right they were just next to the royal palace. You see, that would be the symbolism there. Now, Malcolm said that book I highly recommend is It Pursues Genius, and reading about Abraham Flexner. Yes, Flexner played a very big role in putting American medical schools under control of the government, having very strict regulations. Now, Travis says there's a limited amount of gold in the world. If we ever adopt the gold standard, the population would continue to increase exponentially. The amount of gold in the world would stay the same. Wouldn't this cause problems? The population grows too much over time, with gold stored up and saved by relatively few people in proportion to the expanding populace. Wouldn't this also lead to an unstable economy? No, because remember, the purchasing power of the gold would shift in relation to demand. I mean, you would have it's one point Mises makes in Theory of Money and Credit is any amount of money in an economy is optimal, essentially, to do the job. It's just you just shift the purchasing power, I mean, of the unit. You don't need, with more population, you don't need more units. It's just the units of money you have will have more purchasing power if they're more in demand. So you'll have more people want money, so that'll increase the demand for money, which means money will have greater purchasing power, so prices will tend to go down. World War One as fulfillment. Oh, yes. Now, China, would competing currencies solve this? There'd be a better solution than the gold standard. Well, I think it's very likely that with competing currency, people would settle on the gold standard. I mean, people would tend to want to have a common currency. It would be just like you would be saying, your question might be saying something, well, is barter better than having a single money standard? And you think no. So I mean, you could have people in a free market offering different currencies, but there would be a tendency for people to settle on one or a few. Lessing says long price reflects the amount of money in the economy, does not matter. Yes, that's what the Misesian point of view would be. Now Malcolm says, in lecture one you mentioned if anyone's following the battle between Matt Smolensky and Murray Rothbard and asked if anybody's following it, I searched but didn't find anything. I spelled Smolensky correctly. Can you give some details of this battle so I can find? I don't remember. Do you remember, Malcolm? I didn't refer. Oh, I see what you mean. No, what I was referring to is on the Bleeding Heart. I see what you mean. In the Bleeding Heart Libertarian site, it's called Bleeding Heart Libertarian. There's a philosopher named Matt Zwolinski. It's Zwolinski. He was a student at Mises University at one time. So he wrote a criticism of Rothbard's non-aggression principle, and there were various people responding to that. I had a few things to say. So that was what that was about. If you go to the Mises site on your Circle Bastiat, you can find some posts by me on it that will give you references to that. Okay, so let me see more questions here. Travis said, gotcha, so people storing up large amounts of gold, even with the population expanding, wouldn't harm or influence the economy then. Right, I mean, it wouldn't do any damage, that's right. Travis says, are you still bickering about NAP? George Smith finished this argument. Just go to libertarianism.org. Matt's a nice guy there. Yes, I did read George's response. I didn't agree with all what he said, but I thought he was on the right lines. Yes, I've known him a long time. I met him in 1978. They had some pretty good slugfest between George and Matt Swolinski. It was funny. Now, Leslie says, don't the political class in poor countries have a stake in discouraging foreign investment? Economic progress would lead to more political freedom and thus threaten their hegemony. Would this be a reason why India was so slow to open up to foreign investment? Well, I think that is sometimes a factor. I mean, they could think it would displace their own position, but very often it can also lead to them just trying to control the foreign investment to their own advantage or to steer things their way. But I think you're right that a complete free market wouldn't be in the interests of people who want to gain a position by coercing others. That's a very good point you raised. Travis says, are they in the comment section? Yes, I saw Matt and George go at with each other. It was hilarious. Yes, it was pretty good. Good. David Corwin, with current trade agreements, government subsidies, tax policy, central bank printing, and multinational statute, said, is there such a thing as a free market any longer? Well, I mean, there obviously isn't a free market, if you mean by a free market something without those government interferences, but you still have free exchanges taking place within those restrictions. And one thing I think some of the left libertarians make this mistake, they think, well, if you have the government interfering with things as they do today, then it's you really have a completely different system. But one point Mises makes is there's no economic system intermediate between the free market and socialism. Now, that sounds odd when you hear that because you think, well, isn't just what we have is such a system that we don't have complete free market, we don't have socialism either. What he means by that is if you have a restricted market, it isn't operating under other economic laws than the free market is. So you still have the same explanations of how prices are made or established and so on. So you could still have trade within the government restrictions. Now, Travis says that he's tired of people thinking that libertarianism is a right-wing ideology. How do we break people of this false mindset? Well, I don't know. Maybe we could send them to concentration camps. We'll have to think about that one. Sorry, that was just one of my jokes. But, well, I think basically you just have to explain what libertarianism is and how it differs from both conventional right-wing and left-wing views. Now, Travis says, conservatives never support economic freedom. They support economic nationalism, emergence of national socialism. Malcolm says, like being a little bit, praying a little bit of socialism. Well, I mean, that's varied among conservatives. Sometimes they're more favorable to the free market than others. Now, Malcolm says, was Rothbard the first to come up with NAP? If not, has anyone written on its history also used a progressive defense force? Well, I mean, he was, you have the basic idea of self-ownership. I mean, you find that in the English Levellers that I'm supposed to be helping someone with a Mises Daily article on that I haven't done yet. But you find that in the 17th century, John Locke had that. And others, and if you take that as kind of the essential to non-aggression principle, you'd find that earlier. Yes, this article is by Roberto Modugno, University of Rome, on the Levellers. So, I mean, Rothbard was one of the first to write about in the context of modern libertarianism, but I mean, people had the idea of self-ownership earlier. Now, Travis says, John Stuart Mill really developed it through the Harm Principle, which later became NAP. Well, Mill's principle is a little different. I mean, he said that it isn't a sufficient justification for interfering with someone that he's harming himself. You have to be, in order to justify interference, it's a necessary condition that the person's action harms somebody else. But remember, harm isn't the same as rights. You can harm somebody without violating their rights, at least in Mill's conception of that. So Mill's notion of rights is rather different from the NAP. Now, Leslie said, did the development economist P.T. Bauer know Mises and Hayek? Was he sympathetic to Austrian economics? Oh, yeah. Yes, he certainly was. Now, Travis says it parallels that though, referring to, yes, Bauer knew Mises and Hayek pretty well. Now, Travis says it parallels, though, in not really the way Mill developed it. I mean, you could take harm in such a way that it did parallel what Mises and Hayek, Mises and Rothbard had in mind, but you don't have to, and I mean, it depends how you characterize harm. And Mill really didn't allow a great deal of interventions that Mises and Rothbard wouldn't. So it all depends on how you characterize harm and what rights you give. You should look in what Mill had to say in rights, look on the chapter on rights in his short book, Utilitarianism. You'll see what his notion of rights is. And Malcolm says, have you ever thought of doing a course on the most dangerous philosophers of all time? Who would you say would belong to that group? Of course, we know who Ayn Rand would put in the group. I have to think about that one. Now, Travis says Marx number one. Well, I mean, he'd certainly be up there. I like to say about Marx, I know some Marx, but I don't know all the angles. I once gave that joke at a conference in the Marxist G.A. Cohen was there, and he said he'd also thought of that same joke. He was very good on jokes, Jerry Cohen. Do you think it would be a good course? I do. Well, it's one we'll have to think about. It might be a dangerous course. Yes, I always laugh. Rand, in one lecture, called Kant a machine gunner of the mind. I like that phrase. It's rather funny. I don't know how much Kant she'd read, but that was her view of him. Now, Malcolm says, what would be interesting about the course would be the philosophy, but how they affected history and do till this day. Yes, I mean, that would be interesting to trace if the influence of ideas on, philosophical ideas on history is rather difficult to do that, but it would certainly, you're right, it's certainly an interesting area. Travis says, when did Rothbard ever break away from Ayn Rand? Rothbard was fond of Rand originally, but later wrote an occult objectivism. Just wondering if you know the chronology there. Ah, well, that's an interesting question, Travis. See, Rothbard's initial reaction to Rand, he'd known her, because remember, the people interested in libertarian ideas at that time were very few, so he'd been aware of Rand. And his first attitude toward her was rather negative. But then when Atlas Shrugged came out, he was very, very, thought very highly of that book. And for a while, his group, the Circle Bastiat, met with Rand's group. Then they had a falling out. They were critical of the fact that Murray's right wife, Joey Rothbard, was a devout Christian. They didn't like that. And then there was an accusation that Rothbard hadn't given credit to Barbara Brandon for a particular argument on free will that he used against determinism he used. Of course, it wasn't that good an argument to begin with, but never mind it. So then they split up after that. Now, Russ wants to know, what would you suggest for reading Kant? Lisa, start with, well, I always like Groundwork of the Metaphysics and Morals is a good one. Has anyone written on the subject of Jesse Rothbardian analysis? Which subject? Malcolm, and did the two actually meet together, Bastiat and Rand? Yes, for a while they did. The Circle Bastiat, which was just a few people, would come to visit Rand in her group, which is called the Collective. And Travis says, Rothbard believed in free will. Yes, that's right. I like to say on free will, I believe in free will. I have to. Stephen Corner has, yes, that was in the Penguin series. Stephen Corner, he was a Czech philosopher who lived in England. One of the most dangerous philosophers. I think there's a man named Benjamin Weicker, W-I-K-E-R, who has a book on the 10 most dangerous books of all time. I think Tom Woods knows him. Well, okay, everybody, so I think we're out of time now. So this is the last lecture in this course. I want to thank all of you for coming to my course. It's been a small but very good group, and I hope we'll be seeing you in my next course, which is on broken capitalism. Thanks to everybody for all your good questions. And Russ wants to know, would I teach an informal logic course? Well, I mean, that's a possibility. I'd at least give it some informal attention. Oh, I'm glad, Malcolm, you've been very good coming to a lot of my classes. I appreciate it. I have some very good students. I'm happy about that. Okay, thanks, everybody. Okay, can you like my course? Thank you. It's very kind of you. Hope to see you again soon. I'll have one more quiz for you. Okay, thanks, everybody. Bye-bye. See you again.